This is Mae Brussel. It's part two of a one-hour broadcast called World Watches. It's program number 713. In case you picked up in the middle, it's a weekly analysis of various events, past, present, and future, how the past affects our future. And I want to continue with the subject of Hiroshima and Nagasaki and what followed after the bombs were tested in those two cities. I want to read directly from this book, From Hiroshima to the Moon, by Daniel Lang, just a couple of sentences on the transition in July and August to the emphasis from Los Alamos down to New Mexico and the next stage of World War III that was to begin to escalate. This is what Mr. Lang wrote. At the outset, the hard work entailed in establishing the post at New Mexico seemed pointless. The Army didn't move in until July 13, 1945, when the Nazis' guided missiles, the original inspiration of the place, were no longer in business. They allegedly were building this New Mexico base for the missiles and rockets, and the war was over, and all of a sudden the Army is coming in with a full blast where they weren't so visible before, and as of July 13th, 1 month before Hiroshima and Nagasaki bombs dropped, they took over it with a large influence, and the Nazi-guided missiles weren't even used. They were used in Europe, and the war, for all purposes, was over, except these men knew it wasn't. Mr. Lang says the people there thought maybe the Japanese would come up with a similar weapon, and we needed it. But when the Japanese surrendered, the men were puzzled by their labors. You see, we're told that one war is to end all wars and the other one is to end all wars of the past again, and all of a sudden, the escalation in New Mexico. Toward the end of August, however, big news reached the proving ground, and this is after the two big bombs had been dropped. By the end of August, this great news, big news, reached, and everything suddenly made sense on why they were set up and what they were doing. The American Army in Germany, counting its captured assets, already had 100 V-2 rockets in its possession, and they were sending them to New Mexico. And it was clear then that by both V-Days, Japan and Germany, that were celebrated, that the Army intended to pursue its project into peacetime, this is a quote I put on that, and on a sustained basis. Shortly thereafter, 300 freight car loads of Nazi rocket parts arrived from Europe and were transported from Las Cruces over the highway to White Sands, New Mexico. Now that the station had rockets and the experts knew how to fire them were needed. Here again, the Nazis helped out. Toward the end of the European War, before the Germans gave up, the Allies and Russians independently were on a specialized liberating foray, the point of which was to round up the Reich scientists, the technicians, the engineers, presumably to help win the next war. This is exactly what he writes. Before the war was over, before the Germans gave up, we and the Russians were rounding them up to win that next war. The American undertaking was known as Operation Paperclip, and it seemed to have done rather well in harvesting of rocketeers, including Count Wernher von Braun, the expert, only 31 years old, who headed the Peenemünde rocket station in northeast Germany, where the V-1s and V-2s rained on British soil, bombed the British, and then people that were stationed in England then avoided those bombs falling on their heads, the survivors, came back to New Mexico to help with this project, and they moved to Fort Bliss in El Paso. The American scientists and engineers worked together, and they, according to this author, they never discussed politics or religion. So well did the Peenemünde group carry out its assignment that Americans in White Sands felt an uncertainty over who organized which, whether the Germans were running it, the War Department was running the Germans, or whether the Germans were running the War Department. At the end of 6 months, the Americans themselves learned how to shoot the V-2s. The Germans were sent to Fort Bliss, where they continued to occupy. He wrote this in 1959. They then were moved on to Muscle Shoals, Alabama. Wernher von Braun delighted Army officers with his grasp of American slang. He was permitted to return briefly to the Reich in order to marry his fiancée, an 18-year-old girl. All of them wanted a citizenship in America. Their children were enrolled in schools in El Paso. They had automobiles and money when they arrived, the latest models, and were treated well, and the army carefully shielded them from journalists while they went about and did their work. The Army Ordnance Journal printed a story. This goes back to earlier than 1959, the occupation of Mars, and this was one of their projects. Remember the book Alternative P3, and people put it down as being impossible to ever reach Mars. But the goal of these people was to control the world, and the scientists working on this were men from Johns Hopkins and the industrial complex, such as General Electric, Douglas Aircraft, and Bell Laboratories, were working with them. And of course, General Electric put Ronald Reagan to the GE Theater, so he was known throughout the entire United States before he decided to run for governor of California. Now, jumping to the space part of this, a while later, these men are now in New Mexico and then soon in Muscle Shoals, Alabama. And when this book was written in 1958, the author described a conference in New York at the New York Academy of Sciences called Man in Space, a Tool and Program for the Study of Social Change. And it tells about the problems of being separated from people on long trips to space and the psychological work of changing their mindset for going on such long trips. And they even posed the problem at this conference earlier than 1958. What would you do if we sent our people to another planet? And those people were both scientifically and militarily equal to us, but were also in unity with their own mind and were more peaceful in their own minds. How would you behave sending them into that kind of a field? This was a problem. Political order may come about because our people wouldn't be a match for those people who already are more sophisticated. So the problem was, do you bring them back to space or would they come back with their ideas? And they discussed problems of Mars. And then in these discussions, there was a subject of developing patience, because good spacemen may have to take 2.5 years. And they decided that studying a sedentary life or in a Buddhist monastery would be good, or Eskimos. And keep in mind, in the 50s, after the 50s, how many people have moved to the United States, like Bhagan, the Rajneesh group, and the Transcendental Meditation group, and Mr. Erhard, Ludwig Erhard, and who changed his name and went into the Est, and all these various groups trying to set up places for people and learn meditation, and how important it is for so many people today. They've depended on it. And it was part of a program. These people have come to the United States, but I wonder if they are part of the program that was set up to study sensory deprivation and what happens when you're in space, and get people's mindset to the way of meditation, bring it to this country, useful for space colonies and space stations and future astronauts. Now, Dr. Harold Papinski wrote in the American Psychologist magazine in 1958. He's a professor at Ohio State University. He came up with the notion that ideal space voyagers should be midgets, a female midget with a PhD in physics. But the midget is interesting because Omni magazine wrote an article a few years ago on the necessity to biologically alter people to make them adaptable to space. And these space scientists were working on midgets. I'll do more later, but this isn't applicable to Hiroshima and Nagasaki now. But I have believed for a long time, and possibly stayed on the air, that that disease, progeria, P-R-O-G-E-R-I-A, is linked to the space experimentations. Those are people that grow older but stay small as children. They're little tiny midgets, but they have adult heads and take care of themselves. There was a famous Meg Casey who died this year, and a woman from San Jose, Alicia Gowans. I would like to get in touch with her parents and maybe find out what medications she took when she was pregnant. I never have done that in San Jose. I should do that. But when you take the pictures of these faces, they're identical to what people are seeing in UFOs that land. And I believe those UFOs are man-made, and that those people are altered genetically in some way so that they are hairless and they have large eyes that almost bulge, big black eyes. Their ears are pointed, small chins, and they have adult heads in little bodies. And this was exactly what was planned with those same people. The meditation and the reduction of bodies for adaptability into space. Just last week, Larry King had somebody on his program, a magician, who partook in a group with the Maharashi. The Washington Times, the Reverend Moon paper, has a large article, well, fairly large, July 19th, Maharashi meditation said to foster utopia. This is to get you satisfied, I suppose, for long distances or somewhere. At the Washington Convention Center, there was a two-hour session, 5,500 people attended, but he had 7,000 experts in technology assembled at Fairfield for 3 weeks in the winter to give the world a taste of utopia. And he's working with scientists on scientific research on meditation. The Maharashi is active in Washington. He calls it the creative capital of the world. And he described on Larry King's program, using members of Congress and various people, he's tapping them all into what he calls, or what is known as, the unified field. The effects are similar to radio waves on the brain. But it's interesting, in 1985, how much news there is about trips to Mars and on the Maharashi and different kinds of meditation similar to his. And also, these people are identifiable, who are grown up, who are tiny, and the intent of the space program to recruit those kind of people. When the bomb dropped, the bombs dropped in Japan, there were three people controlling all of that part of the world, China and the Philippines and Japan, in control of the whole series of operations there, the grand plan that go back to Germany and to Washington. Douglas MacArthur, Charles Willoughby, whose name is Weidenbach, the German from Weidenbach, from the Kriegs Academy, and General Albert Wiedemeyer. Those three are very, very important. So I just want to wind up this broadcast on the anniversary of Hiroshima and Nagasaki by talking about General Wiedemeyer. I can't do a lot in the remaining time, but just a little bit of his influence, again, leading to World War III. Pardon me, the plans for World War III. Just recently, Ronald Reagan honored him as a great American. He can if he wants. He's still alive, and he just had him at the White House recently. I want to just quote a few sections out of the book, Wiedemeyer Reports, written by General Wiedemeyer. That's a good source to start with, I believe, just as I do with the Simon Wiesenthal book, the book that he wrote. Take their direct quotations. He describes going to the German War College in 1936 to 38. He had graduated from West Point. He went there and was served in the Philippines from 1925 to 27 and worked with the General Staff School, the Command and General Staff School of Fort Leavenworth, and then was put in the Intelligence Division of the General Staff to attend the Kriegs Academy. That's the German staff school where they send their people, and he became the first American officer since World War I, Mr. Albert Wiedemeyer, to go to Germany to study with the German officers. He was there when they invaded Austria in 1938. He was with them from 1936 to 1938, and it's very important because Mr. Weidenbach attended the same academy and then went out to the Philippines and was attached to Douglas MacArthur, who affected so much policy after the war. So he is then sent to this academy, and he describes going to that war college. I was assigned to the War Plans Division of the General Staff. Now, being in military intelligence, Henry Kissinger was put in military intelligence, and his mentor from Germany, Fritz Kramer, was in military intelligence after the war, but this precedes those days where a member from West Point, a United States citizen, is sent with the Nazis to be trained with them and then make so many influences after the war with our officials in Asia, particularly where he then went on to China and worked with Chiang Kai-shek and then to Formosa, and that began the China lobby, the World Anti-Communist League, Reverend Moon, the churches with mind control and controlling masses of population through manipulated, concerted effort, pre-planned, and all working and tying together. He goes to the Kriegs Academy. He said he went for a and got a deeper and broader understanding of international affairs from the German state of mind and the causes of world tension and conflict he got from the Germans. Thanks to his assignment in Germany, he understood more than just what he got in America was a military science, but there he got the point of view of the Germans, and that's what Fritz Kramer was giving Henry Kissinger and working with him and his protege Alexander Haig after the war. He talks about his 2 years at the German War College. While there, they traveled extensively in Europe. He got to know a lot about Europe, and he talks about the German courses that were conducted with extremely well-educated and prepared professors. The great geopolitician Haushofer, Haushofer, took over the classes several times. Now, they explained the Heartland theory, the principles behind it, and how the military history was affected by various obstacles that, in this case, they're trying to overcome. So, in this college, they study the stress of the campaigns of Frederick the Great, of Napoleon, of Caesar, of Alexander, of Philip of Macedon, World War I tactics. And if you think that we're behaving like Napoleon and taking countries, or Alexander the Great, those are the people that the German War College studied to conquer the world. We studied the campaign of Frederick the Great and Napoleon by going into the area where the battle was fought. The military history instructor reviewed the situation, analyzed the tactical decisions. My first instructor, my principal one the first year, was Ferdinand Jodl, J-O-D-L, brother of World War II Colonel General Alfred Jodl, who later was condemned at Nuremberg as a war criminal. Major Jodl conducted the course in tactics and techniques the entire year. He was an outstanding teacher. Prior to going to Germany, I read an account of what is he refers to the Heartland theory, taking the Eurasian heartland to control the world. That's what they studied at the college. He read the book before he went there, The Theory of Sir Halford Mackinder, M-A-C-K-I-N-D-E-R. The Germans had taken Sir Halford for their own. He proceeded to improve upon them. The Heartland theory consisted of Eastern Europe to preclude an attack from the East to Germany. If you're thinking of going to West, first take the East. His idea was to control also Eurasia and Africa. The world island would enable a continental military empire to outflank the oceans. Outflank. This, in popular parlance, meant we would put America and Australia in the hole. They studied to put America in the hole from both sides. It was planned, and these people then took over the Pacific Ocean and the European, and have been doing that to us, I believe, ever since. Remember the word in the hole. In Bismarck's way of talking about the heartland, it was a matter of Bohemia, as a matter of Europe, master of Europe, take Czechoslovakia, and they studied the map and how to take Czechoslovakia while he was at the War College, 1936 and 1938, and then they demonstrated by taking Czechoslovakia later. My 2 years in Germany led to valued friendships. Many closest friends among the German officers were killed in a plot to kill Hitler in July 1944. And then he goes on to say that those conspirators, headed by Ludwig Beck, were in continuous contact with the American OSS representative in Switzerland, working under Alan Dulles. That's William Donovan and Alan Dulles. Dulles became head of the CIA. The very Germans that were in the War Academy, when they saw the war was over, Dulles was arranging a plan whereby we would combine with the Nazis and go against Russia then, and Hitler would be dead, and everyone would assume, well, if Hitler's dead, the war is over, we'll forgive, because he was the loony one. So his friends there at the academy, many of them, were used by Alan Dulles later, moving on then to 1944. He's in the school from 1936 to 1938. And then the very buddies that he was the closest to linked to Mr. Donovan and Mr. Dulles in Bern, Switzerland. He said, my 2 years in Germany left valued friendships, as I said before. One of my German acquaintances was a confirmed Nazi, Herr Gerhard Rosbach, R-O-S-S-B-A-C-H, from whom he rented his apartment in the Wilmersdorf section of Berlin. I was informed that Rosbach was intimately connected with the Nazi movement, a front fighter. Rosbach fought in Poland against the communists after World War I. When the war was over, he was one of those like Vaslov's army still shooting at the Russians. He was a close friend of Captain Rome, the leader of the Nazi brown shirts. Some of Hitler's closest associates thought they wanted to kill Rosbach because he was an accomplice of Rome, but Hitler spared his life. In his living room, and Wiedemeyer rents from him, there's a picture of Adolf Hitler. I had a picture of Hitler draped with a Nazi flag prominently displayed in my apartment. I promptly replaced Hitler's picture and the Nazi flag with President Roosevelt and American flag. But Mr. Rosbach invited me to parties where top Nazis were there, such as Rudolf Hess and Goebbels and Goering and Martin Bormann and others. And he goes on to describe Mr. Goebbels, who had a diploma from a Jesuit college, and Rudolf Hess and Field Marshal Goering, and his relationship with the top officers from the school, who also were, several were sent, one from Bulgaria, one from Mussolini's Italy, one from Japan, fascist Japan, one from Turkey, and he was the representative from the United States. He tells about going on a ski trip that was arranged for the war college. They always went with an instructor in the first spring, and while they were there, the Nazi troops went into Austria. That didn't bother him. Our American from West Point was with Nazi Germany, the only American officer since World War I, the first one who was over there while the Germans are invading Austria, and he's getting tactical lessons just as we could use to sweep in our blitzkrieg into Grenada. We now can go to Nicaragua and El Salvador and take all of the countries we want once we show that we have the mock Nazi and the German helmet caps to do it. Now, he talks about Colonel Truman Smith, a friend of his who was the military attaché at the U.S. Embassy in Berlin while he went to the war college, and Smith kept me informed on the Nazi war machine. He wasn't from West Point. He was a Yale University graduate, classmate of Archibald MacLeish and Dean Acheson, and he was familiar with the Army's foremost intelligence officers. He worked with them. He himself was an expert. He kept abreast of the developments, the new weapons, and he also was close to Charles Lindbergh. He brought Lindbergh to Germany to meet Reich Air Marshal Goering and see the German aircraft, and Mr. Wiedemeyer was escorting his friend Smith was escorting Lindbergh, Charles Lindbergh, who wanted us to stay out of the war and not get involved in that. Now, as soon as Germany was the war with Germany was over in May 1945, May 8th, from early 1945, just at that time, Mr. Wiedemeyer, Albert Wiedemeyer, was sent to China to be in charge of General Chiang Kai-shek. He said the German officers who helped Chiang Kai-shek build the nucleus of a modern army in the early 30s perceived the basic weakness of the nationalist military establishment, and they wanted to remedy it. General von Seeckt was invited to China by Chiang Kai-shek in 1933 to pattern the Chinese army on the German model, but they had difficulty working with Chiang Kai-shek, and the plans fell apart when Japan invaded Manchuria. He goes on about how the Russians were about to go into Manchuria, and part of the agreement at the end of the war was the Chinese sovereignty over Manchuria that had been promised in Cairo was given away at Yalta, that Roosevelt and Churchill secretly promised Stalin at that point that he could have Manchuria, that far-reaching concessions in Manchuria that had belonged to Russia before Japan went into there at Port Arthur in the 1905 war against the Soviet Union. Japan invaded the Soviet Union. This time they have fought their second war, and Russia wants that area, that controversial area that they lost in 1905. Japan had been trying to take the Soviet Union, and Stalin was assured at the end of the war that it would not go to Chiang Kai-shek. So Mr. Wiedemeyer is very important. He flies, of course, to see Douglas MacArthur many times, and he describes one of those flights over them. He says in his book, America fought a war like a football game. And in the other book, they referred to it as a basketball game. But keep assured for one thing, it is a game to them. And we, as stated before, are not important to them. And Wiedemeyer says when the war was over, people wanted to go home and celebrate. And that would be disastrous. The things we fought for wouldn't come through. That you want to forget the war and go back. And he said the trouble with American people is they don't realize the conditions in other areas or what happened after the war, that there was victory in these various places. They wanted to come home. Congressmen promised to send the boys home to please the constituents and to return for their next election. And for the most part, they were unmindful of the fact that the communist conspiracy was in an even greater danger than the Nazis and the Japanese. And this is Albert Weyermeyer saying, you have to understand that the enemy is Russia, not what Japan did or wanted. Visualize yourself under a conquered Japan and visualize yourself. I wouldn't be here if there had been a conquered Germany. And buy the book Dora and read about how Pundemund was run, and then see Mr. Von Braun, General Von Braun, running the space program here. It is horrendous to think what they did and what showed up, the tortures and the war policies of these people. They weren't just grabbing territory for their own survival. The whole history of that war was terrible. And Weidemeyer said that the congressmen at home didn't understand that the Germans and Japanese were much better, far better, than the communists. Then he described, I'm not defending some of the things that Joseph Stalin did or the way that the government is run in the Soviet Union, but a good part of their behavior has to be on a defensive always, because they were attacked from the day they had a revolution, and I think they had a right to have a revolution. Now, Albert Weidemeyer describes in the spring of 1947 how General Eisenhower had sent him to England to deliver some lectures at the Imperial Defense College in England. It no longer is defense, like our Department of Defense becomes the offense. He lectured there, and then he went on to Germany to see his friends from the old German Academy. The war was over now, and after all the damage they had done from 1936 to 38, he attended that school. He went over there to visit the academy, and he reminisces about the plans for a new war. He said, "Describe my last mission to China," where he goes back after the war, and soon Chiang Kai-shek is to be out, and he's be in Formosa. I was told the communists thought that my arrival as ambassador to China, and that was very controversial, was the result of a major United States decision to prepare plans for a new war. They had come to the conclusion that my mission was designed to prepare the ground for this purpose with the full cooperation of General MacArthur, and they conjectured I was there to ascertain what form aid to China we should take. Now, this was going way back to 1947 when General Albert Weidemeyer is sent back as ambassador to China with Chiang Kai-shek, and the Soviet Union knows that the purpose is to prepare for World War III. Now, in conclusion of his book, he describes Hitler's mistake of what is called the grand design, how he was grilled to take the Soviet Union, how it failed, the decision to attack the Soviet Union was made in June of 41, and the mistakes of Hitler. And it's interesting how he details what errors Hitler made, because those are exactly the mistakes we're making today. We are letting those people who go to the Kriegsakademie in Germany and our West Point and Annapolis people draw on paper, like a ball game, a basketball, football, the grand design to repeat with the help of the Germans how to take the world. And after he describes the errors that Germany made, it's exactly the errors we're making today. They don't learn a thing from their experiences. They think, if I had moved a little left instead of the right, if I took England instead of Russia, but it's not going to be that way. The Soviet Union knew before the war was over what we were planning with the Germans, and they were forced to arm and are equal or more supplied with arms than us. So now it is a question of facing each other eyeball to eyeball, or, as Harry Truman said, to show us the way the world is, and that's the way it's going to be. The weapons are bigger. The people are just as stupid. The brains aren't any bigger, only the weapons. But that is all I have to say right now about Hiroshima, Nagasaki, World War III, and the intent of these people to continue while one operation is going to get ready for the next. This is Mae Bressel. I'll be back with you next week, and we'll then continue on Simon Wiesenthal.